Will be from Luke chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. Luke 16, 1 through 4. He also said to his disciples, "There was a certain rich man who had a steward and an accusation. And an accusation was brought to him that this man was wasting his goods. So he called him and said to him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward.' Then the steward said within himself, 'What shall I do? For my master is making the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig, I am ashamed to beg. I have resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, that they may receive me into their houses.'"
Good morning. Listen, if the song leader says there's another verse, and you just keep singing. That's the way we do it around here. I'm sorry, Hayden. We'll teach him yet. I'm going to continue our series out of the book of Luke. We'll be looking at yet another pretty stern thought from Jesus in this series. And we're going to take it from Luke, the 16th chapter, which I almost regret. When I planned this series, I was working on a kind of series of passages that I thought would go nicely together, and they do, and this morning's lesson is not an exception to that, but I bit off more than I could chew, because Luke 16 has two of the more difficult parables Jesus ever tells. The first one, in the beginning of Luke 16, is probably the most difficult parable Jesus tells to understand. It's a challenge. If you look in the commentaries, they're especially helpful. They say, "This is the most difficult parable Jesus ever tells." And then they move on, and that's about it. Or they say something like, "There's much debate in the literature concerning this parable," which is great if you want to debate, but if you want to preach a sermon, it's a little more difficult. Luke 16 reminds me that in dealing with parables, there's a very thin line between a parable and a joke. When you tell a joke, how do you do that? You ask the person you're talking to kind of imagine a situation. Of course, now I can't think of a good joke to tell you, so that's just too bad. But you know how a joke starts. A priest and a rabbi and a minister go into a bar, right? You start off and you set up some scenario, and then you have them do something silly, and then there's a punchline. And the point of a joke is just to make you laugh. A parable kind of has the same structure, that you set it up with some kind of situation. Imagine this situation. It's believable. It could happen. But then something kind of peculiar happens, and then there's a punchline. Only the punchline, instead of making you laugh, is supposed to make you reflect and rethink your entire life. They're a moral challenge, an ethical challenge to you. This one kind of reads like that. It's variously named either the parable of the dishonest manager or the dishonest steward, depending on who taught you to say it, something along those lines and how your translation handles it. And just a few things about it that are odd. First of all, who is he even talking to? In verse 1, it says he said this to his disciples, and then you read the entire parable and you get to verse 14, and it says the Pharisees were listening and they ridiculed him. So you may find that strange. I'm talking to my disciples, but it's the Pharisees who respond, who are not disciples, right? So the only way I can kind of figure this out is he is telling this parable to his own disciples and maybe sitting behind them or standing behind them in the corner, kind of lurking with their arms crossed, are the Pharisees listening to the parables, and when they hear it, they just kind of snicker and say, "This person's out of his mind," which is apparently a fair response to this parable because it's odd. I suspect the disciples didn't ridicule him. They just scrunched their brow and said, "Well, we don't know what just happened, but I guess we're supposed to learn something." And so there's two responses. If you go away from this morning's sermon and some of you have your brow kind of scrunched and some of you just say, "That was ridiculous," then apparently I told it right, because that's the parable that Jesus tells. It's a difficult parable to understand. What makes it difficult is it's a parable about a person who does something bad. We call it the parable of the dishonest steward or the dishonest manager. It's not the parable of the honest manager and you should all be honest like him. It's a parable about a guy who seems to be a crook. And at the end of the parable, the master, usually when there's someone called the master in a story and a parable that Jesus tells, we expect the master to be like God. And so at the end of the story, the master looks at the steward and kind of laughs and says, "Well, that was clever." And that's how the story ends. But it was crooked. It was bad. He cheated the master. But there's a story about someone who cheated his boss. And so that makes it a little bit strange for certain. Verses 10 through 13 seem to give you the morals of the parable, but they're almost random. I don't want to say they're completely random, but they don't. When you just read them through, it's not clear what the theme is of these statements of morals. What is the punchline of this parable? What was I supposed to take away? It seems like there's two or three points he's making, and it's not immediately clear which one is the point you're supposed to get from this story. So that's difficult. And again, it reads kind of like a funny joke. It's just a silly story about this guy who cheated his boss, and everyone laughs. And then Jesus says, so should you be in the kingdom of heaven. And that's really odd. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to do the very best we can. If you get done and you're still scratching your head, you're in great company. I can show you lots of commentators doing the same thing. I think there is a fairly straightforward point. It's just some of the details that are difficult to kind of put together. And we're just going to do the best we can with it this morning. Prepare to be challenged, I guess. Starting in verses 1 through 4, what was read for us just a moment ago, we get the basic problem of the steward. And here we go in verses 1 through 4. He also said to the disciples, there was a rich man who had a manager, or your translation may have steward. And charges were brought to him that this man was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this that I hear about you? Turn in the account of your management, for you can no longer be manager. And the manager said to himself, well, what shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I am not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from the management, people may receive me into their houses. Okay, so here's the story. Let's just get the basic parts. This steward or manager, think of him like middle management. In the ancient world, he would have been some kind of servant or slave, but he would have been the head slave or servant, not a field hand. He's someone who is trusted with the management of the business. He owns none of it. None of it actually belongs to him. It belongs to the rich man. But passing through his hands is a substantial amount of the rich man's property and wealth and possessions and business. The rich man doesn't want to deal with the accounting, and so he turns it over to the head steward who takes care of that. And as a result, this man has a lot of power. None of it's really his, but he has it in his hands. A lot of wealth, but none of it's really his. It just kind of passes through his hands. And an accusation is brought about him about he's made a mess of it. When it says in verse 1, he's wasting his possessions, it doesn't mean he's wasting his own possessions. He's wasting the rich man's possessions. The head steward is making a mess of the business. He's losing money left and right. And someone accuses him of this. Your manager, your head servant, is just making a mess of your business. He's wasting your money. You're going to be broke. And so the rich man calls him to account. What would we call that? It's an audit. He says, I want to audit the books. You're going to be fired. Let's just make that clear. You're going to be fired, but before you leave, I want to audit the books. I want an account given of all the money you've spent and how you spent it so that I can turn it over to somebody else and know what took place here. So the manager's problem is that he's done for. He's made a mess of it. There's not even any defense made. The manager doesn't say, no, I did a great job. You just look here. There's no excuse given. He just knows, I'm done for. So his plan is to create a soft landing for himself. Okay? He knows he's on the way out. He just needs to land softly. He's not keen on the idea of going out to the field to dig. Why can't he get another job as a manager? Well, what does his resume look like? Fired for gross incompetence is not a great way to get your next job as a manager. So he's not going to get another job that's as cushy and comfortable as this job, and he knows it. So he says, I've got basically two options. I have no other skills. I can go dig a hole, and that's not exciting. I'm probably too weak to be out doing manual labor, or I can go beg. How insulting is that? To go from every day handling heaps of money, not yours, but handling heaps of money to going begging for bread. He says, well, I don't want to do that. And so, as people tend to do, he comes up with a plan, a scheme. He's going to make for himself a scenario where no matter how this turns out, when he gets fired in a little while, people will owe him a favor. So remember, in the ancient world, very strong rules of honor and debt and gratitude. Someone does you a favor, you have to do them a favor back. Right? That's, you lose social standing if you don't return favors, even more so than in our culture. And so he says, I'm going to play a game with what I have at my disposal. And what does he have? Well, until he gets thrown out, he still has the business. And so he's going to make use of the master's wealth to get some people indebted to him, not in money, but in favors. And then when it's all over, he'll have a place to live. He'll have some place to go. So here's what he does in the verses that follow, beginning in verse 5 down through the first part of verse 8. So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, "How much do you owe my master?" He said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, "Take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, "How much do you owe?" And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, "Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. And let's pause there. So what does the man do? What is he doing here? Let's just be clear. I know modern debt collectors actually do something very much like this, and that's what they're supposed to do. The modern debt collector says, "We know we can't get the entire amount out of you, so we'll settle this debt and somebody gets some money out of it for a lesser amount." That doesn't seem to be what's happening here at all. Do you suppose this is what the rich man had in mind? Turn over the books. You're about to be fired, but before you're fired, short sell all of my debts and get me less money than they're worth. Does that sound like what the man had in mind? Not at all. This is crooked. And one of the ways you know that, Luke gives you a hint. How does he say to do it? Sit down, write down quickly, here's how much you owe. Is that something you do when you're doing something that's legal? Hurry, write that down. Hurry. Right? He's in a hurry. There's something surreptitious about this. There's something very sneaky going on. He is trying to pull a fast one, and so he says, quick, how much do you owe? He should know. He's the steward, but he doesn't even take the time to look it up. How much do you owe? Quick, write this down. And he writes down less. And he's not interested in fairness or doing the best deal for his master. He doesn't haggle. Shouldn't we haggle here? Well, you owe 100. How much can you pay? Oh, 80. Well, how about 90? Can you do 90? I mean, that's good haggle. He doesn't do, quick, write down 80. Yeah, 80 will work. Just give us that. And he doesn't even get to keep the money, right? He's not stealing the money. He's stealing the favor. By getting the person's debt reduced crookedly, this person now owes him a favor. He made it so I owe less to the rich man. I owe him a big one. And what's the man's scheme? When he fires me tomorrow, I can go out to these people and say, "You know, yesterday you owed 100, today you owe 80. I did that for you. You owe me." How does the master respond to that? I don't know how to make of this. Again, there's a thin line between a joke and a parable because the master just thinks this is kind of funny. He commends the man for his shrewdness. He doesn't lock him up, which might have been an option. Or maybe he does. Maybe he says, "Well, that was very clever of you. Now let's go to prison." I don't know what the rest of the story is, right? Jesus doesn't tell us what happens next. But whatever happens next is irrelevant. What's important to the story is the master says, "That was very shrewd." Now, shrewd's not a word we use very often. Maybe close to the English word clever or something like that. In ancient culture, shrewdness is a wisdom that doesn't necessarily care about right and wrong. So in the Bible, it always says, be wise. Because wisdom cares about virtue. Wisdom is doing the best thing in the best way. Shrewdness doesn't care so much about doing the best thing, just as long as you do it well. Shrewdness is a little more pragmatic. This man probably broke some laws, probably cheated his master. He's not really worried about that. But what he did was really clever. I mean, it was really smart, right? He arranged for himself. He owns nothing, and yet now the whole town owes him a favor. He traded nothing and got something. That's pretty clever, okay? Not good, not virtuous, but clever. Okay, so that's the peculiar story of the dishonest steward. What moral could we possibly tell from that? Is this a story you tell your children at night? Let me tell you about the man who cheated his boss. Grow up and be just like him. See, it's a difficult story to teach, isn't it? So what is the point? Jesus picked the story. No one handed it to him and said, make a point out of this. Like, I got handed this in the Bible, right? Luke says here, this is what Jesus said. Jesus picked this story. He told this story, made it up from scratch, I guess, and said, here is a story, and this tells us something. Let's take a look at some of his morals that he's teaching. End of verse 8 and then verse 9. So verse 8 says, the master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness. For the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. In fact, there where it says dishonest wealth, literally, and some of your translations may have it, a term we don't use often, dishonest mammon is the term used. Mammon, which is gain or plunder or the things of this world. Does this sound like an odd story for Jesus to be telling? It does. The moral is even stranger. He says, make friends with your dishonest wealth. What seems to be his point? Let me make a couple of suggestions for what I think he's trying to say. People in this room, let's apply it to us, are some of the wealthiest people the world has ever known. I know in our culture, we're middle class, upper middle class, lower middle class, somewhere in there. We're not the wealthiest in our culture. But in world history, Americans are some of the most blessed, comfortable, wealthy people. We have been blessed materially. And there's really no question about that. So ask this question that the shrewd man asked himself. What would a clever person do with his wealth? This man realized he was going to lose his access to his wealth. It wasn't ever his wealth in the first place. And he was going to lose access to it very soon and have nothing. And so what does he do? He gives it away. He gives it away because it's about to be worthless. And he trades it for something that's not worthless. A favor. Think about something that you might have that could be worthless. If you had some stock, and I told you tomorrow all of your stock will be absolutely worthless. All the stock holding you have will be worthless. That stock is going to crash. What would a shrewd person do? Well, hang on to it, right? Just keep it. No. You sell it. If you know tomorrow it will be worthless, you get rid of it. What if nobody's buying? You sell it for something. You say, hey, I'll pay me for dinner and I'll give you some stock. I mean, you find something. You can owe me one later. I don't care. Just take. You try to find something to get out of it because tomorrow it's going to be worthless. Let me suggest to you that that is very much like the wealth that you have right now. What I think Jesus is reminding us, everything you have, you are merely the steward of. Your wealth is not yours. The God of creation is the rich man. The God of the universe owns all that you have, and he has simply put it into your care. And all too often we've mismanaged it. If we knew tomorrow it was going to be worthless, and it is, there's a day coming when everything you own is worthless. Your wealth, your possessions, your stocks, your home, all of it will be worthless. What would you do? Wouldn't you trade it for something that's not worthless? Jesus says, do you realize you have that option every day? Look at verse 9 again. And I tell you, make friends for yourself by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. There are poor and impoverished people, needy people in this world, to whom your wealth that will soon go away anyway would make a big difference in their life. Suppose that you took your wealth that's not going to go with you anyway and gave it away. Instead of keeping it and building a mansion that will crumble, what if you just gave it away and short-sold that stock? And instead helped people that were actually in need. What would be the result of that? Jesus says, you would get something out of that far better than the crumbling mansion or the goods that you hoarded up all your life. You would have made friends with your wealth of people in need, and God cares very deeply for them. Like that dishonest steward, perhaps you would secure for yourself an invitation into the eternal dwelling place. And this is kind of a funny turn on phrase here as well, a little turn of phrase. He says, you'll be invited into the eternal dwellings. I don't know what everybody's translation has is. That Greek term is the word tent. What is the most temporary building you can think of? It's a tent. He says, you will be invited into the eternal tents. What's his point? You are trying to build up wealth here in this life, and it's going to crumble. Your mansion that you thought was going to secure you, your wealth and your possessions, it's all going away. But there's a tent somewhere else that has more glory and more stability and more future in it than anything you have now. Trade your mansion for the eternal tent. Get invited into the abode of God. No mansions there, but what you have there will be better than what you have here. See the point he's making? When he says in verse 8, the people of this world are more shrewd than the children of light, what he's trying to say is, you ought to know better. How do you deal with your money? If you know you're going to lose it all, you trade it. He says, well, guess what? God's telling you, you're going to lose it all. You can't take it with you. It's all going to burn. None of it matters in the long run. So stop hoarding it up to satisfy yourself and start doing something with it that would have eternal consequences. Do something good with it. Help share the gospel with it. Feed people in need with it. Do something good. That's what a shrewd person. He doesn't even say a good person. He says, if you can't be good, at least be clever. That's what a shrewd person would do. Make the right business deal here. And that seems to be the point of the parable. He's going to elaborate this in a couple of points about dishonesty. Because remember, this is the dishonest steward. Nobody thinks he's a good person. So now he's going to reverse it and tell a little moral about dishonesty and how the Christian should behave with their wealth. This is a rebuke, as I've said, all of these are rebukes in some form or fashion. This is a rebuke to those of us who are dishonest with our wealth. How can you be dishonest with wealth? Well, one way is to forget who it belongs to. The steward thought it was all his, and so he spent it any way he wanted. Your wealth isn't yours. And you don't get to decide what it gets spent on. God's priorities have to come before yours. Read verses 10 through 12. One who is faithful in a very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in a very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? God has blessed you richly. He has given every one of us resources to spare. And He's looking to see, will we be honest to what He wants done with it? Or will we be dishonest? Will we be faithful to the one who gave us the wealth or unfaithful? Because it's all just borrowed and none of it is ours. He says, if you are dishonest with your wealth, if you aren't doing what the master wants done with it, why would you think he's going to give you anything else? Do we expect riches in heaven? Boy, we got songs about that, don't we? There's a street of gold, there's a mansion over the hilltop, there's wealth and all. Why would God give you wealth in heaven if you squandered your wealth on earth? If He blesses you now and you can't figure out what He wants done with it, why would He open up to you the pearly gates of this wonderful new realm to go to? Seems to be the point God is making. Right now is the question. When God blesses you, will you use it as He desires? And that's the test to determine whether He has anything else in store for you or not. It's an irony, actually, because the faithful use of God's riches is giving it away. Isn't this interesting? This is complete opposite of the story he just told. The steward was dishonest because he kept giving away his master's stuff, and he wasn't supposed to. oddly enough, that's exactly what God wants us to do. God wants us to give. But what do? We store it up. We hold on to it. Well, there's a parable about that, isn't there? This reminds us of another story, a simpler story, where a man goes on a trip and he leaves behind his three servants with differing amounts of talents or money. And every one of them that takes a risk and does something with it is rewarded. Who's not rewarded? In fact, who's scolded? The one who buries it in the ground and does nothing with it. He says, I have returned to you exactly what you gave me. I hoarded it up and kept it safe. And the master seems to say, I didn't want it safe. I want it used. God has not given you blessings for you to keep them safe. God has given you blessings to do His will. And that requires risk. That requires loss. But that results in great gain. To keep God's wealth and make ourselves wealthy here is being called dishonesty. Because it's not what God charged us to do with what He's given us. Which leads us finally to this last point. If the verses 10 through 12 is a rebuke of those who are dishonest in wealth, then verse 13 is to those who are dishonest in their love. Look at verse 13. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. If you think about it, the story of the dishonest steward is about a man who is trying to serve two masters. He was trying to keep his job by making his boss happy. Who was the other master? Him. He wanted to keep himself happy. He wanted to do the things he thought were good. And that ended up in not doing what the other master wanted. He couldn't satisfy himself and correctly use his master's goods. And so he picked. And he satisfied himself. We all pick. We have been blessed beyond measure. And Jesus says, now you have a choice to make. Who is it that you love and adore? Who is it that you serve? Is it the God who has blessed you with these goods and said, use them for His purpose? Or is it yourself and the unrighteous mammon and comfort that you can gain by hoarding those things up? By keeping our wealth, we have made mammon our master. We think that we've made ourselves our master. We haven't. We're serving the money. We're serving the goods. Jesus personifies this mammon. You've made it into a little god, and now you serve it. But by giving away our wealth, we have said that what we have is not our own. Have you thought about the deep significance of the collection plate on Sunday morning? That's obviously not the only example of where we give of ourselves, but one of the prominent Christian examples of giving is on Sunday morning we pass around this plate, and a room full of people, in theory, are saying this, this didn't belong to me anyway. Use it for the master's purpose. And God says, that's honesty. That's shrewdness. That's doing what you're supposed to be doing with someone else's money because it was never yours. The question then for you that are being rebuked and for me is, do we serve the one we say we serve? I can't say I serve God and He's Lord of my life except for my money. We love a good exception, don't we? We love to be, for Jesus to be in charge of everything but. We like to cordon off little parts of our lives and say, well, not there. Preacher, stay out of that part, right? I don't want Jesus anywhere near my wallet. If Jesus is Lord, He has to be Lord of all of it. And so the question of honesty is, do I recognize Him as actually being the one who possesses all that I possess? That everything I have is merely borrowed from Him and to be returned. And that's the question I think we need to end with today. If you have kept all of your blessings, I think what this passage is telling you is you have not used them wisely. We spend a lot of time and energy wondering about the future, a future we can't predict anyway, about financial questions and what to do with it. The wisest thing you can do with every dollar you possess is to make sure that it is used in God's service in some way. And that'll be different for every person. I'm not here to give you a budget and say, here, do this. Not my job at all. But when you look at your budget, the first question you ask yourself is not, am I making ends meet, or am I saving enough for retirement, or am I whatever? The first question, all those are fine, the first question has to be, does my budget show that I know that none of this belongs to me? Am I using this as a wise servant, or am I using it dishonestly? Take a look at your checkbook today and ask yourself that question. Ask yourself about the things you spend money on without a second thought. Things we'll purchase without a question. Whether we've got the money or not, we'll spend money on that. And then ask yourself, does this show that I have made the Lord of the universe the Lord of my wallet? Have I showed that He is my Lord and not my money? And when you ask yourself that question, I usually don't like the answer. And maybe that's why we don't like this parable either. Every aspect of our life has to be submitted to God. Today, we would encourage you to take a look at your life in every aspect. And if you find in it anything that is not submitted, made subject to Jesus the Christ, the Son of God, then in faith and obedience, repent. And take that and make it His. Because it's His anyway. Every bit of it. Even me? Yeah, even me. Ezekiel says it this way, last verse and I'll close. Ezekiel says, all souls are mine, saith the Lord. Not just what you have, but your very person belongs to God. And it's time we start acting like it. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. If we can help you in any way, won't you come?